I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
I really don't drink alcohol. I mean, maybe once a month if we go out to dinner. And right now, really what's motivating us is, number one, when I have a glass of wine, I immediately fall asleep. And when he has a beer or something to drink with dinner, he does not sleep well the whole night. And with 5 kids and busy careers between us, we can't afford to have a bad night's sleep, and drinking alcohol doesn't make us feel good. And truthfully, another reason why I don't really drink is because my family has a history of alcohol and substance abuse. Alcohol, as well as drugs, is something that I've always held at a very far distance and kind of been afraid of. I never wanted to use drinking as something that I relied on to unwind or to feel better. And honestly, when we started Motherly in 2015, we knew as a company that there were so many memes out there about it's wine o'clock for moms and mommy's little sippy cup as a way to cover up the hardship of motherhood. So from the very beginning, we knew that we were not going to be a mommy wine brand. I've been around the parenting space long enough to have witnessed a real evolution, more sober curiosity, more people talking about why is it that we give wine and alcohol to moms as a solution to her struggles instead of paid maternity leave or family-friendly workplace policies. In many ways, alcohol covers up the deeper issues in our society and within ourselves. So today's opportunity to reflect on how maybe you or we individually use alcohol, and also how we as a culture could better support moms when it comes to their relationship to drinking and their well-being. Hey, Mama, welcome to the Motherly Podcast, where we have honest conversations about modern motherhood. I am Liz Tennedy. I am a co-founder here at Motherly, and I'm also a mother of 5 kids myself. Today's guest is Annie Grace, author of The Alcohol Experiment and This Naked Mind, 2 best-selling books that provide tools to help people take an unbiased look at their relationship with alcohol and addiction. Anne and I have a candid conversation about our relationship to alcohol and how our personal and family dynamics were affected by it. We also get into the alcohol industry's pivot from targeting men to luring women, pitching alcohol as an escape from the stress of motherhood. Annie Grace, welcome to the Motherly Podcast.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited.
What surprised you about motherhood?
Well, first of all, pregnancy surprised me. I was one of the ones who was sick the entire 9 months, and I thought that morning sickness was going to be like a little husband holding my hair back, pukey puke, feel good all day long, and then no problem. I've had 3 kids. So what is that? Basically 10 months per kid, 30 months of just absolute torture, a lot of not being able to get out of bed. And so I think the surprise for me was like, why didn't anybody tell me? And my mom, she's like, well, I was sick too. I was like, why didn't you say something? She's like, I think we forget. I'm like, yeah, I think we do. But yeah, that was surprising.
How did you get through that time and then choose to do it 2 more times?
Well, I always knew I wanted 3 kids. I remember getting through the first month of the first pregnancy and being like, okay, I have 27 months left with my second and third pregnancies, I would lay in bed and I would hold the hand of one of my little toddlers and we'd just watch TV or something. And I'd just be like, this is the why, this is the why, this is the why, as the whole world is spinning and I'm trying to just not puke. But it is obviously so worth it. The most important thing I've ever done is become a mother. But I was blindsided a bit by how intense that experience was for me. And some people love being pregnant and I'm so happy for them.
Were you diagnosed with hyperemesis gravidarum?
Yes. And so the first pregnancy I was on the Zofran, the anti-cancer drug that helps you not to puke. And then the second one, there was some studies that had come out about that causing some birth defects. I think those studies have resolved themselves. So then I was trying to go through with like vitamin B6 and bonine over the counter and piece other things together. Those medicines helped me to at least get enough nutrition. And it didn't make me feel better though. And I think that was another surprise, was I thought, okay, if I'm going to be on this anti-nausea medicine, it's going to make me feel better. No, it just didn't make me puke. I still felt nauseous.
I've had hyperemesis gravidarum 3 times. 2 of my pregnancies, I did not have it. For me, it always fades mid-pregnancy, but it's hard to describe how earth-shattering it is. And there's nothing else that can really exist. What did it teach you about your resilience, strength, or even the need to surrender in some ways to that experience?
This is such a brilliant question. And in fact, it's something in a roundabout way I've been thinking a lot about recently. I've also had anxiety since I was a kid, but I was officially diagnosed at 19. And pregnancy was so interesting because while I was so nauseous, I wasn't anxious. And so I was feeling emotionally peaceful, but physically very nauseous. And then with my second son, I ended up having very severe postpartum depression in addition to all of that stuff. And I only had it with one of my 3 pregnancies. But I was thinking recently, because I still have anxiety attacks and panic attacks, and I manage it through all sorts of different ways. But one of the best things I actually did for my anxiety was to stop drinking because I was using alcohol to self-medicate so much. But in that experience of my body reacting chemically in anxiety, my mind panics. It is like, life's never going to be okay again. Everything is wrong. Gloom and doom. I'm obviously broken. All of my birth experiences were drug-free and my first labor was 25 hours. And my mental ability to coach myself through physical discomfort is so immense. And it's such a lesson. And I was just recognizing recently that I need to build that mental ability to coach myself through emotional discomfort. I'm a biological being and I'm having an emotional experience just as if I'm cold, just as if I'm nauseous, and it will end. It's like my anxiety, there's never been a time in my life where my anxiety has not passed.
I've had such similar thoughts. You know, the experience of enduring hyperemesis gravidarum where it's hard to keep living. It's hard to keep going. It's hard to face that. And in ways that are so deep and existential, and I never experience outside of going through that. I gave birth 11 months ago. For some reason, that labor was way longer and way harder than almost all of my labors. I had an out-of-body experience. I was like communing with dead people. I felt myself outside of time through the intensity of that birth and just the strength and wisdom that our bodies give us the opportunity to explore through pregnancy, through birth, through so many other hard challenges. I think this podcast and the work that you do, we create spaces to look at these peak intense experiences in life and figure out what we can learn from them and how we can grow from them.
Wow, that's incredible. I remember one of the things that I would cling to in the moments of intensity during childbirth was that women, I could just see almost this like line of women all throughout history who have never had some of the interventions we have now. And I'm just part of this legacy of women doing this thing for humanity. And it was very, yes, existential and almost surreal in that sense. And on a lighter note, I also knew the instant that baby was out, I would not feel nauseous anymore. It was so uncanny.
Everything is temporary. And I think motherhood becomes a really great vehicle for that lesson to be learned over and over again. Let's talk about motherhood and alcohol. Where were you in your motherhood journey when you decided to re-examine your relationship to drinking, to alcohol?
So my son is 12 now, and I have not had a drink for 9 years. So he was about 3.5, 4 years old. And I was living a life that really crept up on me. I was drinking very normally for most of my adult life. And when I had that postpartum depression, I did get on antidepressants, but I also really turned to alcohol. And so the first 3 or 4 years of his life, I just started drinking more and more and more. And during this time, I had some really alarming moments. There was a time when I would ask him to come sit on my lap and he would say, "No, mom, you smell bad and your teeth are purple," because I was drinking red wine. Or I don't remember actually is a better way to say it, his third birthday. I literally, there's photos, there was a train cake, there was lots of friends. We had some friends staying with us from out of town. I don't remember any of it. I had made sangria in the morning, put it out, and just started drinking. And for me, those things, I'm like, what am I doing all this for if I can't remember it? And so it was just so much noise, but I didn't necessarily know how to change anything. I was starting to feel more and more guilt, more and more shame, more and more uncomfortable with how much I was drinking. But I also really, truly believed that alcohol was the duct tape. Like, it was the thing gluing my entire life together. I was a global head of marketing for this company where I was traveling. Within 6 weeks of him being born, I was porting hundreds of ounces of breast milk back through foreign customs in places like the Middle East, always being tested for drugs and with the dogs and, you know, just separation, but just really trying to do my best, pumping in airport bathrooms. And as soon as I would pump, have a few drinks and then test, I would carry around the milk strips with me. And it was like, this is how I can do all of it. I can do all of it, be on the plane all the time, be at home, be a wife, be a mom because of the alcohol. That belief was so, it was unexamined to the point that I believed it. Like, I believed the sky was blue. And yet these little cracks in that belief system started to show up where I would lose memories or I would regret what I said or did. Or, you know, my husband would be like, "Can we just take a night off? I mean, we haven't had a night off drinking in a really long time." And I would feel panic. And I knew that was not normal. And so all of these little signs really were mounting. And I honestly, I didn't know how to escape. I thought, well, I'll just start drinking less. And Liz, I did not find drinking less easy. I could do it, but every time I did, I felt deprived. I felt sad. I felt like I was missing out. I felt like I was really condemning myself to this gray, boring, sober life. And if I'm really honest with you, that was unacceptable to me. So the two options in front of me were to stop drinking and feel miserable, literally miserable, because it was like you were cutting off your arm or losing your best friend, or keep drinking and feel less miserable, but then have these points of really low guilt and shame waking up in the middle of the night.
Where do you think the idea came from that somehow alcohol was the solution to your problems as a really busy working mom of multiple kids?
Oh, I've given this so much thought, because one of the false beliefs that we all carry is that if we're over drinking, that it's our fault. And now I'm so certain, and I can prove it scientifically, I can prove it sociologically, it is not our fault if we're over drinking. We have been handed this belief system, and it comes from all sorts of different places. But all you have to do is look around and see how people deal with stress. Alcohol industries have actually started to really monetize these beliefs. So they've created specific brands of wine that target moms. Mommy's Time Out is a brand of wine, or Mommy's Sippy Cup. There's all of this just really intense targeting. And we think this stuff doesn't affect us. But the truth is, if it didn't affect us, they wouldn't spend billions of dollars promoting it in those ways, right? We're very highly susceptible to these beliefs. I was in marketing for decades, and I had the inner track. And there's psychologists and behavior specialists who know arguably more about the human brain than the average person, and more about the triggers of the human brain than the average person. And they are paid to be in on these meetings of how to best market alcohol. The rabbit hole really goes deep in terms of, okay, if we put the wine in a place where somebody can touch the bottle, there's an emotional connection with actually having touched the bottle. And so there's all of this pre-work. But then the alcohol itself, it does some really specific things in the brain. So as soon as you have that drink, when you're in a moment of stress, it slows down your thought processes. As women, especially, some of our most pain comes from just overthinking and feeling like we're just in this whir of rumination and what could go wrong and holding everything together there for everybody and feeling like it's all on our shoulders. And all of a sudden, that quiets, not because the alcohol is being our friend, but because it's literally slowing down your neural synapses. And so we feel that relief and boom, the marketer's work is done because the drink itself can confirm. Now, the problem with that is that that experience, that feeling, it only lasts for about 20 minutes with one drink. And I really encourage people to time it for themselves because I've had people write in their times. Some are 18 minutes, some are 25 minutes. But that one drink, that nice feeling really only lasts for that long. And that's when, you know, your blood alcohol content is rising. And so it gives these nice stimulant effects of alcohol, of feeling calmer, feeling more peaceful, feeling more energized, all the reasons we drink. But what happens is the body sees alcohol as a toxin. I don't like fear tactics at all. I think they're completely useless in changing our behavior. But just factually, your body will stop digesting food if alcohol comes into the body and prioritize purging the alcohol. What happens is your body says, this is important to get this alcohol out of our system. All of these processes kick off, and alcohol about 20 minutes after the first drink becomes a depressant, and your blood alcohol content starts falling, and it gives you all of these very negative feelings, feelings of uneasiness, feelings of uncertainty, feelings of tiredness, fatigue. We don't connect it with the drink we just had that made us feel good. We just think, oh, that's just how I felt. And then we're incredibly tempted to reach for that second drink to keep that going. And it's cumulative. So 20 minutes for one drink is 2 to 3 hours of the depressant effect for the same drink. So if you drink 5 or 6 drinks, you're talking 10 to 15 hours. And so you sleep through it. And that's why you wake up anxious the next morning. I didn't know any of this at the time, but my experience was very much that my anxiety, it wasn't fixing anything. I was self-medicating with a medicine that had no ability to fix anything. I remember friends being like, oh, you feel bad? Let me bring over a bottle of wine. I remember doing that myself. Like it was just what was done from this whole collective belief system that we carry around alcohol being the one thing that is socially allowed sort of to self-medicate.
I'm really glad you brought up the example of mothers trying to hold it all together and alcohol being presented as a solution when, as you explained, for all sort of scientific reasons and factual reasons, it's not the answer. Frankly, when we started Motherly 8 years ago, it was really important to me that we were a counter voice in wine mom culture, because I'll tell you, 8 years ago, all the memes out there and the jokes, it was all about that. And thankfully, I think we've made a few steps forward, but I'm really curious as an expert, how did this idea seep into motherhood, the wine mom culture? And where do you see us today, if not in that exact same place that I saw us as a culture 10 years ago?
We saw our husbands drinking and relaxing with alcohol. And for a long time, we didn't do it. Women drank much less than men. And then in the 80s or 90s, that started to shift, especially I'd say late 90s, early 2000s. I found a study that I've not been able to find again. I literally think they took it offline, so you'll have to take my word for it. But it was a paper that came out of the alcohol industry that identified women as an underserved segment of the market, and then put together ideas about how they could market to women to bring women's consumption of alcohol up to men's consumption of alcohol. And I think one of the ways in which that was done was to actually call on the part of women that want equality. And so it was almost through this feminist lens of, hey, you can be just like your husbands. Here's drinks for you that aren't just beer that tastes bad. Here's the wine cooler. Here's the White Claw. Here's the low-cal. Here's the skinny girl wine. We're going to drink too if our husbands are going to drink. We're going to be the ones also relaxing. We're not going to stand by the side and just let them have beers after work. Like, we're going to jump right in. And of course, since alcohol, like, the one thing that every medical doctor agrees on is that it's addictive to the human brain. And it's more addictive when that human is in stress. One of the things that I think is actually kind of beautiful that came out of it, I think wine was the wrong tool, is that we started really supporting each other with this mommy wine culture. It was also tribal. It was also, okay, we're all going to get together and have play dates and wine. And it's not just going to be that we're sacrificing ourselves to the kids. We're also going to have social life and social time. And I remember driving home from some of those play dates, not remembering, waking up, being like, oh my gosh, is the baby in the crib? Going, running in, checking, the baby was in the crib. I had no memory of how I got home. And I know that's a really true story for a lot of moms, but we're just like trying to unite in this and trying to provide for ourselves what hasn't been provided for us in society. I think one of the things that I see that is so heartbreaking is there's been a lot of mom shaming for drinking coming from moms, right? I've seen some memes and just things where we're waking up to it. And then we're like, oh, well, now we need to attack the moms who are over drinking. And I'm like, oh, no. We moms, we have been doing the best we can with the tools we have. We have literally been trying to carry the torch, hold it all together for ourselves and everyone around us. And we've used alcohol because it was available and because it was handed to us on this silver platter of brainwashing. We're not to blame. And we did it out of an act. I truly believe that we have been over drinking out of an act of self-love and self-preservation. And so there's no shame in it. It's just simple curiosity of, okay, is it working for me? And then, you know, maybe I'll experiment with different levels of alcohol, but without the guilt, without the shame, because that's the last thing we need any more of.
Well said. So tell us, how did you actually yourself turn from that person who was self-medicating with alcohol to deal with the stress of life to someone leading a movement of helping people live sober lives joyfully and without, I guess, the labels and shame associated with what we conventionally think about as alcoholism or alcohol abuse, those kinds of things?
So in that really dark part of my life where I was suffering from postpartum depression, also from anxiety, and feeling very out of control with my drinking, but also feeling like it was my best friend and actively trying to drink less, I would make rules for myself and I would break those rules. I would keep them for a few days, like, okay, I'm only going to drink on Thursday nights, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I'm not going to drink during the week. And I could do it for a few weeks and then something stressful would happen and I do it and I drink and then I feel so much shame and so much guilt. And it created this really intense internal cycle and battle. And I've now coached thousands and thousands of people. And across the board, usually the moment that we decide I'm going to drink less, cumulatively over the next few years, our drinking increases. It's very similar to the diet culture, where if you start to diet, cumulatively, statistically, on average, your weight goes up. And it's because the same mechanisms are happening in the brain. And I didn't realize it at the time, but I knew that I couldn't even look myself in the eye anymore in the mirror because I just didn't like what I saw. And I felt so let down because I kept breaking these promises to myself. And I was actually coming back from London and I was coming back to my two young boys. I had been over there the entire week. It had been a very boozy week. I'd even had a few drinks in the hotel restaurant on my way to the airport just to get to the airport and help nurse my hangover. And I was in the airport and I was just hysterical. I'd found some deserted place to sit in this train tunnel in Heathrow Airport and I was just sobbing because I could not get control over this thing. I felt pretty smart and in control in every other area of my life. And this fermented liquid in the glass was just something that I could not easily let go of. And it felt so tragic when I did. And so I was asking myself all the same questions that I'd been asking myself for years, which were, are you an alcoholic? Do you have a problem? What's wrong with you? And in this really just, I don't know, you can't really describe it any other way, but sort of like a divine voice sort of said, well, why don't you ask why? And I was like, huh, why? Yeah, that's a really good question. Why did I used to be able to take it or leave it? Why did I not even drink in college? Why is suddenly this thing the center of my life when I know other things are more important? And so I made a pact with myself in this moment, and it was pretty radical in the recovery circles, but I wasn't in any recovery or sobriety circle, so I had no idea that it was radical. And I said, okay, I'm going to stop trying to control my drinking. I'm going to let myself off the hook. I'm going to drink as much as I want, but with the caveat that I'm going to spend at least the next year finding out why. And so I made myself a reason of every single reason I drank. And when I asked my friends for every single reason they drank, one by one, I drank to relax. I drank to be more joyful and more happy. Well, turns out that the effect of alcohol in your body creates a stress response in the body by releasing cortisol and adrenaline. Your brain actually releases counter chemicals to bring down your cumulative pleasure that don't leave the body as easily as alcohol. So your net pleasure in your life goes down and you stop being able to experience pleasure from things that you used to, like a nice date night or reading a good book or a cozy fire, just don't do it for you anymore without the glass of wine because of this effect. Turns out that the cumulative effect of alcohol is even that pleasure. Tolerance is actually like immunity to alcohol. It's just your body learning to purge it quicker. So you stop even feeling it. So you're not even getting the effects, but you want it more because your body's starting to crave it. And so I went through like, helps me loosen up for sex. Turns out it actually numbs all of your senses, including your sense of touch, which is not good for sex. I really like it with wine and food. Turns out it also numbs your taste buds. So it's not actually useful in terms of making food taste better or making a gastronomic experience more enjoyable. It was about a year of me just geeking out on this and my mind being blown over and over, and I became obsessive. I have ADHD, so it's definitely hyper-focused for a very long time. And I remember walking out of my office and telling my husband, like, you know what? If you want to get drunk with me again, tonight's the night, because I don't think I'm going to drink after this. And that was December 15th of 2014. So how it all kind of transpired into an entire thing now was that I had all that research and I just felt compelled to share it. So I figured out how to put a PDF online. I shared it in a few groups that I had joined, and 20,000 people downloaded it in 2 weeks from all over the world. One man reached out and he said, you should make this a book. I was like, oh, you need a platform. You need Instagram followers. You need all this stuff. I can't do that. And he goes, no, you can self-publish on CreateSpace. And so I looked into that. I found an editor, hired someone to design. One of the women who stopped blackout drinking, actually, she's an artist. She designed the cover of the original book and self-published in October of 2015. And it went on to be such a viral bestseller. It's now sold 1.1 million copies. It's been traditionally published, translated into, I think we're up around 13 different languages. I've written more books since then. The whole book is just the exact narrative of what I went through. Ending the cognitive dissonance of the arguing in your brain, giving yourself grace, awakening compassion, then getting curious and going through the information that really rewires your emotions around alcohol.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
You also talk about the language around alcohol and how kind of conventional ways of treating people who struggle with alcohol are actually can be counterproductive, just like labeling yourself, for example, as an alcoholic. I think for women in particular, there is a particular shame in struggling with something like alcohol, right? Like we want to be perfect. We want to be perfect, period. We want to be perfect mothers. We want to be perfect humans. How has this alternative approach resonated, and why do you think it in particular has really taken hold with women and mothers?
So according to the CDC, only 10% of excessive drinkers are actually chemically addicted to alcohol. And so most of us, 90% of excessive drinkers, are not. And so that entire term alcoholic, which is what they used to describe people who are chemically addicted, doesn't apply to most excessive drinkers, yet there's still a lot of pain. Like I never would have fallen into that category. I could stop drinking without withdrawals or delirium tremens. I never needed to do a detox. And I was in a lot of pain. But when we believe that there's an us and them, there's alcoholics and not alcoholics, we see this dichotomy and we think, if I'm not them, then surely I don't have a problem. I actually remember a friend of mine She stopped drinking one day. She came over to my house. I was pouring her the bottle of wine. She's like, oh, I'm not drinking anymore. I was like, what? She goes, yeah, I went to AA. I learned that I'm an alcoholic. And I was like, really? I was like, am I? And she's like, no, no, you're not. She's like, I was born this way. And of course, this was just hearsay from people at an AA meeting. And of course, none of the science stacks up to that. Scientifically, medically, they don't use these terms. They use the term alcohol use disorder, which is a series of 11 questions. And interestingly enough, if you answer two of the 11 questions affirmatively, you have alcohol use disorder. Two of those questions are, do you ever need to drink more than you used to get the same effect? Every drinker I know would answer yes. And another question is, have you ever had a time where you've drank more than you intended? Every drinker I know would say yes. And so by that actual medical scientific thing, this is an everyone conversation. This is not a conversation limited to that term alcoholic. And I think the term alcoholic, just in general, it's such a, if you imagine climbing a staircase, right? And at the top of the stairs is freedom in your relationship with alcohol. But the first stair is 18 feet tall. Because the first stair that we're asking somebody to engage with is saying, I am an alcoholic, which is a lifelong disease for which there is no cure, and I will have to go to meetings for the rest of my life, always admitting that I'm an alcoholic, separate from my friends, and really live this life of complete sobriety in order to recover. Otherwise, I will die. How likely is it that you're going to be able to, how many people climb that first stair? And that even predicates this rock bottom experience, because we put off the conversation about maybe I should be drinking a bit less because it's so filled with the shame and blame. And we're so unwilling to label ourselves as we should be. You know, anything that comes after I am should be really thought about before it comes out of your mouth. And so this terminology, I have this conspiracy theory. I don't really know that it's true and I don't have a lot of evidence for it, but I'm like, I wonder if the entire term was invented by the alcohol industry in order to keep us under the impression that we could all drink normally. I mean, even if you look at the only disclaimer that has to be on alcohol in America, it's drink responsibly.
I feel like it's the pregnant woman one that I see all over the bathrooms.
Oh, it's for sure. Yeah, that one needs to be posted in all the bars, but on the bottle, all of that needs to be said. Not that this, you know, causes cancer. Not that it is indicated in 60 plus diseases, not that the World Health Organization says there's no amount of alcohol that's safe for a human being to ingest, not that it's actually ethanol, the same chemical compound that's in your gas tank. Drink responsibly, which if you human can't drink an addictive substance without problems, you are the problem. You are irresponsible. So the entire narrative is aimed at keeping us in shame and fear around this conversation.
How has being a sober parent changed your relationship with your kids and your relationship with yourself as a mother?
It's like really incredible. And I think because I came to it without the guilt, without the shame, without the stress, and I really also came to it with truly rewiring my thinking, I wasn't in this place of deprivation or lack. So I wasn't, you know, wishing I could drink, but not letting myself to. For my kids, they see that. You know, my 15-year-old, he came home the other day and he's like, Mom, the weirdest thing happened. I was like, what? He's like, my friend Colin, he brought a coffee cup to school. He's a freshman. And he's like, and there was tequila in it. And everybody was passing it around and everybody was having sips. But I didn't. And I was like, oh, did you feel okay about that? He's like, yeah, there's no way I want to have a sip of tequila. I was like, okay. And he's like, but I feel like I can't hang out with Colin anymore. And I was like, oh, buddy, you can hang out with Colin. Colin's just doing the best he can, man. Can you imagine what his home life might be like for him to be able to get out of the house with a cup of tequila? There's not a lot of oversight right there. I'm like, let's have compassion for Colin. We don't have to judge Colin, right? And he felt the whole thing lift because he thought, oh, Mom's the anti-alcohol person. She's not going to let me be friends. And I'm like, that's just not how it is. I'm the compassion person. I hurt for the people who feel stuck that alcohol is their only choice. Stopping drinking also has... it's been the first step and okay, there's actually stressful things in life and self-medicating with alcohol didn't work. So what's going to work? Well, there's a lot of things that actually do work, right? Like meditating and journaling and good friendships and conversation. And there's so much that does work. And that journey to finding the things that really do work, it's really beautiful. And it fills you with so much confidence because you realize I had such a belief that at any point in my life, it was just the alcohol. The alcohol is why I was, you know, able to network that way. The alcohol was why I was funny. The alcohol was why, you know, I was able to be like the seductress, like, you know, all that And when you learn those skills and you can actually social skills, they're skills, right? And you can actually do those things. I think more than anything we say, it's what we do.
Any specific advice for how to talk to your kids? Like my son's 11 now and his voice just changed. I can see him being the older looking one that they're like, can you go see if you can buy the beer? I could see that being what happens. And I'm wondering how to have those kinds of healthy conversations. How do you recommend parents go about talking about alcohol when we live in such a alcohol-infused culture?
So 11 is such a beautiful age to start having this conversation. And I really think that the conversation needs to be factual and scientific rather than opinionated. I think it's one of the best ways because these kids, they're so interested in the facts. They're so interested in the reality. They're not very interested in our opinions. Sometimes, but not all the time. So I actually wrote a book for kids. It's called Buzz to Buzzkill. And it's the four things that I wish I would have known about alcohol before my first drink. And it's just really scientific. Like, these are the truths about this. It came from me having conversations with my kids and with my nieces and with my nephew about here's the different things that you might be interested in. And then if you do have a journey with alcohol, I'd be really honest. Really honest. We think we have to present this idea to our kids that we have it all figured out and we have to show the best of ourselves. Otherwise, they're not going to think we're a good example. But some of the most impactful things that resonate with a child is when you do show vulnerability and you do talk about your mistakes in a way of like, hey, like I really wish I wouldn't have done it this way. And that's really hard for us as parents because we feel like, oh, we need to present this perfect, but our kids don't think we're perfect anyway.
So I know you used to drink in order to deal with the stress of daily life or to tell yourself, I earned it or I deserve it or whatever you did at the end of that long, stressful day. What do you do now? What other tools have you discovered in your sobriety that help maybe more authentically help you feel connected and unwound and relaxed so that hopefully other listeners may be able to come up with some ideas of their own that might apply to their lives?
I like to have a lot of different options so that I don't feel like hemmed in or constrained by any one option. If you haven't heard of like Byron Katie's The Work, it's kind of four questions of thinking about your thinking, questioning your thinking. It's just a little process. I do that when I have stressful thoughts. It's really useful. I do morning pages, which is something from a book called The Artist's Way. And it's just kind of like you wake up first thing in the morning and you just free write, just to purge whatever stuff came up and then you can have a really clear day, but kind of allow that time for myself. I also meditate. I really like the Ziva technique by Emily Fletcher. She wrote a book called Stress Less, Accomplish More. And it's this very simple technique of like, it allowed my brain to be doing something while meditating. So I didn't feel like a failure. Exercise, going for walks, talking on the phone with friends, creating time and space for fun. Practicing playfulness, which we lose. So like really intentionally practicing playfulness. Husbands are great for that because they're trying to do that all the time. I read a study that said for women, it's the nurture that awakens a serotonin in the brain. So cuddling with your kids, just being on the couch, watch TV with like two kids, like a pile, just dripping in kids, watch a movie, right? For women, that's what really increases those oxytocin and serotonin in the brains with parenting. And for men, it's play, it's roughhousing. It's all the things that as moms are like, stop, you guys are so loud. So really recognizing that and not feeling guilty when you don't want to play with your kids. Like I've never really wanted to play with my kids. I want to cuddle them and I want to parent them, but I don't really want to play Lego or Barbie. And I used to feel so much guilt about that.
That's exactly how I feel. But I am actually actively working on trying to find things that I enjoy. I'm doing a paint by number with my kids. I want to get into gardening and growing flowers and hopefully once I know how to do that, teach them how to do it. So I'm trying to bring them into my world a bit more and make space for that rather than just feeling like the only thing I could do together is kid stuff, which I like you, doesn't really appeal to me.
I recently did a whole day of tie-dyeing with my six-year-old. It was super fun.
Oh, that's a good one. I love that. Well, at Motherly, we believe that motherhood brings out our superpowers. And I don't think that moms are superhuman, but I do think that motherhood transforms us and reshapes us and inspires us. And things emerge out of us that maybe we didn't even know were inside of us before we became moms. So I always want to know, what do you see as your superpower?
Oh, that is a great question. I think my superpower is I have an ability to take in enormous amounts of information and then make it super simple and relatable in metaphor or analogy. And I love it. It's such an intense process for me, but I absolutely love it. And it's something that I think I can do really well. I don't know how that applies to mothering, but I do think my kids appreciate it about me too, because like last night, my 15-year-old was like, oh, I failed this trigonometry test. And I was like, all right, let's get all the information. Let's make it something you can remember. And it was, just a moment of, all right, let's learn everything there is to know, but then let's make it simple so that it doesn't go out of your brain next time you have a quiz.
That's really important. And I think it is absolutely your superpower. Annie Grace, thank you so much for joining us on the Motherly Podcast. That's it for today's episode. Thank you so much, Annie. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. We will be back next week with another great guest. You don't want to miss it. The Motherly Podcast is executive produced by Jennifer Bassett. Our senior producer is Marissa Bramwell. Editing is by Joel Edinburgh. Our music is from the Blue Dot Sessions. I'm your host, Liz Tennedy. Thank you so much for listening.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com. Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.